You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Setting out to write a book, what are the key inspirations for doing so, and how did you approach it?
Well, first was interest. A literary agent reached out that had read an article of an interview I'd done with The Guardian. They said, have you ever considered writing a memoir? And I said, I'm not sure I'd really like to. I've considered writing a philosophy book, and we had a nice chat. And after we spoke, I tried my hand at seeing what it would be like to kind of do both at the same time, you know? And that's how the journey started, really, a few years ago.
Like, how long did it take you to sit down and write it?
I think we started early last year. So it's been a year plus, let's say.
Yeah. What sort of order do you work on when you're putting, do you start at the start and you just write it year by year? Is that how the book comes together, or are there certain parts that you take inspiration for or feel the inspiration to write at different times?
The way we did it was in a way it was chronological, but in some ways it's not, because you end up moving things around in the book story-wise. But, I wanted to start with, originally, I didn't come up with the idea of originally starting with my grandfather's story until a little later. Mm. So I started with my own story, wrote a bit of it, and then I thought to myself, geez, I can't really explain some of these things without going back further.
Yes.
Then I decided to go into my parents' story and then my grandfather's story as kind of like an opener, which is very interesting for a rock memoir.
I thought it was fantastic. It's really good context, and especially it gives fantastic background on, your position and your outlook and the reasons for, the messaging that, is contained in your music and the activism that you're engaged in. It really grounds it for the reader.
Yes. Mm. I it was important to explain. When you're living a life, you don't necessarily have to explain your motivations and intentions. You just do what you do.
Mm.
But when you're writing a book, I think you want to show people where everything came from, in those ways, the motivations, the intentions. And that was the best way I could think of doing so.
Yes. Now, obviously, there is a lot in the book about the Armenian genocide, which is something which is still not recognized by the New Zealand government, which we've actually talked about before on the radio show with a professor of theology. But, I mean, what message would you like to convey to people out there who may not be familiar with Armenia and the Armenian genocide?
The Armenian genocide was the first genocide of the 20th century.
Mm.
Unfortunately, and there were many Anzac soldiers that helped Armenian refugees survive.
Mm.
Based on New Zealand's own archives, there's a wonderful book that was recently written. I can't think of the name of the book, unfortunately, but it's a Kiwi historian who wrote the book and basically shows a lot of the specific stories of Anzac soldiers and how they were involved in saving lives of Armenians during the genocide, and the outpouring of love from Christian New Zealand at the time for the Christian Armenians that were being slaughtered by, the Ottoman Empire. A lot of money was actually gathered in New Zealand and sent through missionaries. It's a part of New Zealand history. And to not recognize it properly as a way of appeasing Turkey, especially in its current form with Erdogan leading that country, is really a shame. And it's shameful for New Zealand, to be honest.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I don't know if it can simply just be boiled down to New Zealand wanting to maintain relations with Turkey simply so Anzac celebrations can go ahead undisturbed. I don't know.
Exactly.
Is it that
and
simple?
That's been the thing.
Yeah.
That's been the thing. I mean, they're afraid that Turkey will be upset and cancel Anzac celebrations in Gallipoli. And that's why they're not recognizing the first genocide where 1.5 million Armenians, Greeks, and Assyrians perished.
Wow.
Formally. The United States has formally recognized it. And many other countries, from France to most of the European Union to South American countries, have recognized it. And none of their relationship have been harmed, you know, with Turkey, because Turkey knows ultimately they're going to, you know, they're going to get upset and they're going to get over it.
Yes.
Because it's the truth, you know? So, yeah, it's just a shame because, you know, I mean, it's the UK not recognizing it formally is one thing because, you know, UK has a lot of deep businesses with Turkey and Azerbaijan and these countries. And, you know, they've had a big shameful empire throughout the world many centuries. But for New Zealand, you know, a country that has always been transparent and accountable and responsible and smart about its foreign policy, to not recognize the genocide is really hypocritical.
Yes, yes. Now, back to some stories contained in the book about System of a Down. I really enjoy the earlier tales of the band jamming at your workplace when you were running the software company. What can you tell us about those early sessions? Wouldn't you say it's like an industrial area that your office was in?
Yeah, it was an industrial area, a bunch of, you know, companies and making products and whatnot. And so I had this 1,000 square foot warehouse, what would that be, about 100 meters square. And, I had it as my offices, a little lounge space for friends. And it was also our rehearsal space. Mm-hmm. We actually, at one point, had two bands rehearsing there at different times. And it was really cool because here we were in an industrial zone outside of town, kind of like being in Onehunga, you know, in Auckland. And nobody's going to hear you late at night jamming, you know, hearing those heavy drums and bass and stuff. It was perfect. And so when we started writing, we were already writing before that in various rehearsal studios, but there we really, our sound started coming together. And it's the first place that we actually performed for people. We would call friends over and had little keg parties and, you know, and at one point you'd have 100, 200 people in this industrial warehouse with a big, you know, bay door open and just, you know, jamming and having a good time with musicians and friends. And so it became kind of like our little circle. So when we played our first show on the Sunset Strip in Hollywood, we had more than enough ticket sales to grab the attention of the would-be promoter at the time to allow us to play that gig.
Yes, yes. Now, you're very lucky to have started working with Rick Rubin from, you know, an early point in the band's career. What was it like to move into the sphere of a person like that at the time?
You know, we had incredible respect for the bands that he had produced, from LL Cool J to Slayer to Red Hot Chili Peppers to Danzig to, I mean, he's so over the place, all over the place, you know, Beastie Boys and, you know. So we had tremendous respect for what he did. We knew that he had a very unique ear, that he would understand what we were doing, because what we were doing was not, how should I put it, standard musical practice.
Yes. <You know>? Yeah.
Our music was definitely left of center, crazy, multi-rhythmical, you know, all over the place and heavy. And so it was not someone wouldn't have said that, oh, this is going to be huge on the radio next year or whatever. You know, there's no way anyone would have thought that. So we knew that he would understand our music. And when he came to one of our shows in Hollywood and saw us play, I remember seeing him laugh incredibly hard because of our antics and our kind of over-the-top performance. Mm. And I just looked at the guys and I looked at him and I'm like, this guy gets it.
Yes.
And he's definitely a heavywig in this industry, you know. The truth is, once Rick had seen us, we couldn't walk away from the idea of him producing us and being involved with us as, you know. So he became our label head, our producer, and he took us under his wing. And we were the first act to go into his partnership with Sony at the time, Columbia Records, and the rest is history, as they say.
Mm. obviously with the band's trajectory and the following that you guys have gathered, you get an opportunity to connect with and meet a lot of different people throughout your lifetime. Who would you say are some of the most impactful or interesting people that you've had the opportunity to meet?
That makes me think of two people who had the same look on their face. this look of purity, childish innocence, and love. The Dalai Lama mm-hmm. and David Bowie.
Yes. What can you tell us about both?
Dalai Lama, I had the honor of being flown in for a TV series that they were doing about music and spirituality, mm-hmm. along with a few other artists, Moby, Katie Tunstall, and Joss Stone. Mm-hmm. And we each had the opportunity to ask His Holiness two questions on camera, one-on-one. And so that was really interesting. And I just remember him walking into the room. We each gave him a beautiful shawl that was given to us as a way of kind of honoring him and whatnot. And he came up and he grabbed my goatee and started playing with it like a six-year-old, yes. basically. And just started laughing and saying, oh, I want mine to be that big. And I was just like, dude, this guy's a Dalai Lama. Like, this guy, I mean, you know what I mean? No inhibitions, no yes. fear of what anyone's thinking of him and all of that. It was just beautiful, you know? Like, you know, it was like this grandfather figure, but so free from the constraints of society, you know? And I felt a similar thing with David Bowie. He had these beautiful, accepting eyes. I've met him twice. I'm actually looking at a picture of him and I at in New York after one of his shows at the Rosemont mm-hmm. Theater. And he had this kind of just beautiful aura about him where he just totally accepting and loving and very cool and very down to earth. And, you know, I mean, I've met a lot of people and there's many, many people that I enjoyed meeting. But I would say these are the two that just came to mind when you asked that question.
Yes, yes. Now, are there any unexpected discoveries or insights that you made or gained while you're working on your book?
Many, many, Johnny. You know, many having to do with my own kind of, you know, just watching yourself in the rearview mirror while writing a book is an interesting process because you realize some of the things you could have done differently. Mm-hmm. However, you did those things because that's who you were then. And there are many, you know, circumstances that made you that.
Yes.
So you can't really change that or want to change that because, you know, otherwise you wouldn't be who you are today. You wouldn't have learned the lessons, I guess, mm-hmm. you know? So, you know, with the band's interaction, there's things that could have been done differently with my own life, you know, I did learn a lot, you know, I learned a lot and it forced me to do a deep dive into my family history as well,
yes.
since I didn't know about my parents and my grandfather. And that became a really rewarding process because of that as well.
With a lot of the focus of the book being your Armenian heritage, how do you envisage mm-hmm. your book contributing to ongoing conversations about social and political issues?
You know, it's above all, it's an activist journey, mm. right? Because that's what I was. I was an activist before becoming an artist. And even though, and throughout the book, you see many situations where the activist is faced with this kind of, dilemma, right?
Mm.
That the musician doesn't have to deal with,
you know? Yes,
because you know, and the choice affects the music and the mm. band and the career and all of that, and what's the right decision and stuff. That's really interesting in the book mm. for me as a writer, and you know, because it's a unique kind of thing where these worlds collide. That's why it's the intersection of justice and spirituality for me, because that's always been the thing.
Mm.
The motivation. And so, yeah, I mean, there's many, many things in there. There are many lessons learned.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, obviously, you've just played two shows with System of a Down in the US. How have those gone?
Really well. We just actually played one show. It was Sick New World in Las Vegas on April 27th. And it went really well. We have another show in August in San Francisco at the Golden Gate Park. Mm-hmm. They've gone really well. Look, one-offs are really fun because yes. they're special events, you know?
Totally.
And, you know, after many years of touring, touring could be fun too, but it gets exhausting, you know?
Yes.
And it becomes repetitious and redundant after a while, artistically at least, you know?
Yep.
You do a 20-show date, by the 18th show, you're like, fuck me, take me home, right? Like,
yeah.
You know? I mean, that's what you're thinking, yes. you know? I mean, you're a pro, so you're still playing it off and probably really tight because you've played all these shows, so your band and your interactions, like, you know, and you could do it in your sleep, you're doing it so well, but there's that, the motivation's different, the intention's different,
yes.
and that bothers me, you know?
Yeah.
But when it's just a few, or one, and it's a special occasion, it's really a lot more fun.
Excellent.
So yeah, they've been great.
Fantastic. Hey, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, Serge. I really enjoyed the book.
My pleasure.
So all the best for the launch.
Thanks for reading it over a weekend, bro.
Yeah, it was
a lot of reading.
I mean, it's a, man, it was a very gripping opener with the 9/11 and then into your grandparents' history, so I was straight through it. So I finished it last night, and I must say I would strongly recommend it to anyone out there with an interest.
Thank you.
Hey,
thank you so much, Johnny.
Awesome.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.